Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus Chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
Hello, welcome to CarCast in Edmonds. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, here with Alistair Weaver. How are you?
Good morning, everybody, or whenever you're listening to this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if morning makes a difference. Everybody kind of listens and whenever, but morning for us.
I used to do radio, and then you could kind of arrive and leave, and everybody knew what time of day it was. But anyway, wherever you are, wherever you're listening.
We were just chatting and kind of getting into it a little bit, kind of behind the scenes of you know, just doing these shows. It's like one of us is landing on a plane and trying to get to and the other one's getting ready to leave and you know, leave the country. And there's just it's kind of a hectic schedule. It's weird when you do the podcast, but the podcasts aren't really like a full-time gig or anything. We're just trying to, I don't know, have some fun, create some content. And it actually gets complicated to schedule that when you go, hey, this is the fun part of my week, and then you're like, I know, but it's tough to schedule the fun part of your week.
This is like light relief. This is my like hour of me time, or me and Matt times.
Right, and it's an hour because you're on the air. You get to go, nobody call me, nobody text me, nobody come into my office, nobody just like leave me alone for an hour. Yeah. Turn off all my communications.
Whatever problem happens in the next hour, I'm live.
That's it. Yeah. Just leave me out of it. Anyway, that being said, we got some fun stuff. I want to bring up, the latest U-Drags video. Looked like you guys were having fun up there. Now you're just pairing stuff together for shits and giggles, I think.
Yeah. There's a sort of science behind it. For if you're listening for the first time or don't know what we're talking about, the Edmonds U-Drag, we were looking at a concept. We look at everybody who's doing drag races, including us, and it was like, oh, it's getting a bit hackneyed, and you know, it's getting a bit bored of it. And also, it didn't really feel very us in that it's just straight line, there's not a lot of skill involved. So we came up with this idea that how can we create a U-drag? So basically, it's a test not just of straight line, but then of braking, of cornering. So it's all over our YouTube channel. But if you basically, it's a straight line, it's a hard brake, it's a corner, and then you've got to accelerate back along the course to basically the finish line is the start line. And it's been a huge success for us. People seem to love the idea that you've got a bit more kind of finesse to it than just a drag race. And because we test all the vehicles at our test track, we have a spreadsheet of quarter miles and braking performance and ultimate grip and everything else from our test results. So we just go through that and try and pair up vehicles that we think will be A, of interest, and B, a close race, because nobody wants to turn up and like one car wins by 20 lengths. So we try and make it as close as possible. We never fake it on the day, but we do go to some length to make sure that we are pairing cars that are some way comparable. So we came up with Durango Hellcat versus Audi RS Q8. Yeah. So you've got kind of American brute force versus, you know, German finesse and, you know, engineering and all that good stuff.
Yeah. And I thought it was a pretty good pairing. Durango's a little hefty. I think, although it's still out, I think like Jeep Trackhawk is probably the more like heads up, but I don't think you guys have one of those. I don't think many people have one of those right now.
No, we've had them in, but also it's, the Durango is kind of funny. I love the idea of a three-row with a 6.2 liter V8 and 710 horsepower. And the big difference on the Durango, of course, is it's all-wheel drive in the way that the Challenge and stuff aren't. So we had a Challenger Black Ghost in, which on a U-drag against a GT500 and others, and it really struggled because it just cannot put the power down. But the Durango is really big and heavy and has all-wheel drive.
Yeah.
So actually does a far better job of getting off the line. And I don't want to give the video away, but we're kind of giving the video away here, aren't we? But it's just super close. And the Durango is just hilarious because she's just so big and brutish. And even the gearbox is pretty crude these days.
Yeah.
But it's just got 700 plus horsepower. So it's really fast. And then when it comes to braking, you basically just mash the middle pedal with all the force that you can muster. And it, and the Audi's on, it was on carbon ceramic brakes. So that just felt like a sports car. And the Durango, you basically just had to mash the brake pedal, get it stopped, and then classic slow in fast out, turn it, and then just fire it out and let the power do the rest. But it was really funny.
But they both got big brakes. Sounds crazy. Right. The Durango's got the big Brembos or something on it. I mean, you know, steel, but not the carbon ceramic, but it's got a pretty big brake on it. Right. So yeah, we're looking at what? We're looking at
it does
710 horsepower, I don't know, 5,500 pounds.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Versus the Audi 590 horsepower, which sounds significantly less than the 710 when you look at it that way. But where does the Audi come in? How much does the Audi weigh, if you recall?
I can't wait. I think it's lighter than the Hellcat. I can't remember by how much, but also you've just got a more, you know, it's not, as we found out in the past, it's also about like how sophisticated the gearbox is, you know, ultimately what's the ultimate grip and everything else. So I don't want to give the game away, but it was a great film, and it ended up going down to the final run to determine the winner, which none of us really expected.
How many times?
It was
do you typically run them when you do? Like the two drivers at least do a pass and then switch cars and do it again?
Yeah, so we try not to do too many runs. I mean, it's a difficult one because you want it to be representative, because we're trying to make it about vehicle versus vehicle and not just a test of driver, which is also why we swap drivers and run in each car. So we generally get up there and we do a couple of practice runs and pick your braking point, get a feel for the car. And then, you know, if somebody says, actually, I need another run, I'm not in tune yet, we'll take that opportunity. And then there are occasions where like one of us has a brain fade, or, you know, maybe the brakes are going off and you miss the apex, and maybe we do an extra run. But we try not to, partly because it's quite an expensive pursuit and we need to get through a lot of races in a day to make it viable. And partly because we want to keep it real. There's a lot of drag races that you see on YouTube where, you know, if you work in the film industry as you do as well, Matt, you know, you can see how it's cut together and they sort of, you know, create a bit of drama out of nothing. Whereas what we're trying to do is, you know, is give something that's a lot more realistic. And that's why we also show, you know, the raw footage of the run at the end of the film as well. So it puts a bit of pressure on the drivers. You know, you've got a crew of like, I don't know, 20 people up there and off you go. And then if you screw it up, you just know there's 20 people sat there in the heat, just chasingly pissed.
Yeah. I we're still going to have to find some time to maybe take your GT500 up against my Mach 1 twin turbo, because I feel like they're very similar. And
what are you doing next week? We're going up next week. I'm not going personally. I'm in Spain on a Volvo event, but are you ready to hear around next week?
I am. I haven't like dynoed the car. I feel like I need to get some numbers from the car. Maybe we should do it when you come back. I kind of feel like you need to be there so we can get a little face-to-face camera time. But I fear your GT500 is on the Pilot Cup Sport tires. And although I have the performance pack, I took those tires off and put the Michelin 4S's on there. It's just a more comfortable tire. So I think there's going to be a little bit of a tire disadvantage, although I'm down to do it. But I want to come in with some numbers on my car, and because I don't know if, you know, we've got the boost really kind of turned down about 6 pounds a boost. And I really don't know if that's putting, you know, 630 to the rear wheels, or is it, you know, I don't know where it really compares completely to the GT500. Now, we can play around with it, I'm sure, but that's how we kind of have it set up, mostly for California's terrible gas. But yeah, I just kind of think turbo versus supercharger and manual transmission versus DCT. What does that do?
And also what I'm enjoying about all of this, Matt, is the fact that, you know, in true racing fashion, you're getting all the caveats in early. It's got a manual, hasn't got the right tires on it, hasn't been dynoed. This is like the best karting dad.
That's how you do it. That's how you do drag racing, right? You gotta go through all your issues ahead of time. I don't think, I don't think they're caveats. The tire thing, maybe, because I had it came with the cup wheels tires, and then I don't have them anymore. But I don't care if it's manual versus DCT. I think the manual is more fun, and I like that car. Maybe the DCT is going to be faster on paper. It should be faster, but who knows? Like what it's really going to end up being, you know?
Does that expression "karting dad" work in America? Is that a Britishism?
The what?
Do you know what I mean by karting dad? When I say karting dad?
No. What is it? No.
Does that translate? Okay. So probably worth explaining. So, you know, like you have like a soccer dad or a football dad, you know, stands on the sideline and screams at the kids or at the referee or whatever it may be. So the ultimate expression of that is like a karting dad. So if you ever went to, this is obviously like where you know, Verstappen's and your Lando Norris and all those guys came through in Hamilton, they all came through the European karting scene. And if you ever go to those races, like every dad there has like got some 6-year-old kid who he thinks is going to be the next Hamilton or Verstappen. And so it just generates this personality type who is just so, you know, obsessive about, you know, somebody breaking the rules or screaming at the kids or just, so it became this expression like, you know, the ultimate karting dad. And I've seen quite a lot of evidence of that in my career.
Oh, I can't wait to be that. I'm going to be that at the U-Drags event. If you guys are going to drive my car, I'm going to be on the sidelines either screaming my praise or disappointment in whoever's driving my car.
So you can be on YouTube. It's funny. People have described me. I've been quite pleased this week because on the Durango film, you know, you get, depending on how it wins, like everybody has an opinion on like you've driven this badly. And I was getting lots of driving tips about everything that we did wrong and everything else. But I did enjoy this week that people were describing me as the blonde guy as opposed to the graying guy, which is what I normally get. So.
Yeah, anyway, what happened there?
I'm going Silver Fox gracefully. What I think we should do is do the we should get you down the two. So we should get your car down the Edmunds test track, run a full set of numbers on it so we know where we stand, and then we can take it to U-Drags.
All right, I'll start modifying.
So I guess
it.
We could do like dyno, test track, then we'll find out.
Okay.
It's a fair competition. And then we can put some money down.
I got to start thinking all my little cheats and hacks to put in the car that I didn't get to do yet.
Sounds good.
I'm not
very
sure
lucky,
what that
we'll
is.
Give you a new, if you're very lucky, we'll give you a new Edmunds U-Drag t-shirt, which is kind of unpredictable.
Sweet. Only if I win, right? Otherwise, I lost, and all I got was U-Drag's t-shirt kind of shirt.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be fun to do and see if all the money I spent was worth it on the car. Or should have just bought the GT500.
I'm assuming that your vehicle is now well in excess of a GT500. It has to be, right?
Honestly.
In terms of cash on the table.
Yes. Yes. As far as price, yes. As far as power, I don't think so. I think we might be very similar. Like crank horsepower, because that's you got a bigger engine in the GT500, you know, so just the displacement there alone.
Well, I think the supercharge is like 2.3 liters or something.
Yeah.
That's
a whole nother engine. That's like a Honda engine on top of
exactly.
of a V8 engine. All right. So going from the loud and brutal, you know, Durango and GT500, you started getting into the fancy and glamour of not just Mercedes AMG, but Maybach.
Yeah, we spent the week in two Maybachs. Now, it's worth just going. Well, you and I were talking about it off air. Maybe it's worth just going back to like the origins of where Maybach comes from, because I've actually followed its journey. So back in the 1930s, back in the 1930s, Maybach was a luxury rival to Mercedes, and slightly, as a lot of things, Germany in the 1930s, slightly checkered history to a certain extent. But then you ended up there. So then Mercedes got into this would be the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And they now basically had diversified their brand so much that they were like, you know, they're really rich people. You know, the S-Class is nice, but it's kind of like an airport chauffeur car. And if you're properly rich, you don't want to walk into a bar and say, I drive a Mercedes. The brand can't stretch enough. So they came up with this idea of, let's do a Mercedes Maybach. And then somewhere along the journey, they said, actually, let's not do the Mercedes bit. Let's just call it a Maybach. So you ended up then launching two vehicles, the 57 and the 62. This is pre the big crash, 2008 and everything. And I got invited as quite a young guy, mid-20s or something. This bizarre invitation arrived. Could I fly Concorde, when that exists, to New York for the debut of this Maybach? So of course, like, I looked at that and went, you know, this is a once in a lifetime.
Yeah, flying the Concorde.
So I flew on the Concorde, which I'm so glad I did, because yeah, I'm a big speed engineering fan, and just an unbelievable experience. Gwyneth Paltrow was on the flight. I remember that as well. Very exciting if you're 25. And the whole idea of flying as Concorde and stuff into New York was they wanted to position this car as a genuine Rolls-Royce Bentley rival. That was the premise of it. This was going to be a whole new brand, a whole new level of luxury. And they said, look, you guys, if you're going to come and report on this car, have to understand the mindset of the Maybach buyer. So we're going to fly you on Concorde. We're going to give you this experience because you've got to get inside that mindset. Fine. No problem. So we landed in New York. They brought this car in off the QE2, arrived in Wall Street. And I always remember, because the car was a bit, I don't remember that car, but it was a strange thing because it looked like a big Mercedes S-Class, because that was how it was originally designed, not as a Maybach. But then the 62 had like business class aircraft style seats in the back. And at the time, that was a big deal. And it was going to be this new level of luxury. And I just remember somebody on Wall Street, in a classic Wall Street fashion, we're looking at this thing, and he walked up and he went, you know, how much is it? I forget now. It's probably like 300 or 400 grand. And he looked at me and he went, it's not enough. Too many people can afford it, and walked off.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called Needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota. So little time.
And like, you know, like, is he being serious? He realized he's been like deadly serious.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, not exclusive enough, not interested. Walked off. And the brand didn't do very well at all. The car didn't sell great because it just looked a bit like an overblown S-Class. It was a bit like naff inside. And people also realized that business class air travel sounds nice if you're flying coach, but isn't actually a definition of luxury. Whereas Rolls-Royce came along with a Phantom, which may not have had all the fancy tricks, but just felt like a world apart.
It so had a big sort of presence my here, back.
Yeah. Massive like, presence and then Bentley was doing its thing.
Yeah. Both of those cars, they, and still as the brand, still had a big presence. And for the for the first, like, I don't know, 2012 ish or whatever, Maybach to have just look like a two tone giant S class didn't quite do it on the exterior.
Was it as late as 2012? I thought it was early, not, but maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, I don't know when it came out originally, but yeah, somewhere around there.
I forget. But so anyway, this thing's this didn't really work as a concept, but the Maybach idea never really went away. And then in recent times, Mercedes have brought it back as a sort of luxury version of an S-Class. So you can now get an EQ, you can now get a EQS Maybach, which is the electric one. You can get a GLS Maybach, which is the gas three-row, it's not three-row, I'll come to that, is a SUV. Or you can get a Maybach version of the S-Class sedan. And they're all, the idea is really that if you want performance, you have now Mercedes AMG. And if you want luxury, ultimate luxury, you have Mercedes Maybach. And it's kind of working out a lot better for them, that it's just, it's quite, they're not as expensive as a Rolls. They're sort of competing maybe a little bit sub Bentley or around the sort of Bentley mark on something like a Bentayga. But they're just a nicely executed, super luxurious car. And what they've done with the GLS that we had in last week is basically, this is a big three row, but they've ripped out the third row, moved the car, and then basically re-engineered the rear quarters so that you've got two kind of business class style chairs that, you know, the feet rest comes up and you can kind of, you've got tables that fold out. And, you know, if you're being chauffeured around and, you know, some Uber exec that, you know, time is money, then it's a really nice way to travel. And the suspension and the ride quality and the overall refinement, I don't think I've ever driven a vehicle with a better ride quality and refinement. It's
Rolls-Royce is going to take offense to that, because
they might. And I haven't driven the electric Rolls-Royce yet.
Their magic carpet ride is pretty on point. It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
You know,
the problem with the Maybach, it still feels like what it is, which is a Mercedes that's been tarted up and, you know, given, you know, sort of added a fancier leather and that sort of thing. The other thing that was crazy about, I was due to take it away, but then the trunk, the car that we had was filled with, you got like little space for champagne flutes between the seats, which is kind of cute. And then behind that, a fridge. The problem is, because this is kind of engineered from a GLS, there's nowhere really to put the fridge. So the fridge basically takes over the trunk. So there's a whole bunch of, there's a certain compromise that come with it, but we drove that. And then also in the last week, not me personally, but one of the team went and drove the EQS Maybach, which is the electric Maybach. And to your point about like electric cars and ultimate luxury just go really hand in hand, because they're so quiet, so talky and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Tell me about Mercedes, your thoughts on Mercedes design. It seems like for a handful of years now, we were all sort of cringing at BMW's design, and then Mercedes came out and with a focus on EV, and I get it. They're like, it's gotta be super aerodynamic. Like, it's gotta be the slickest thing out there. So it's quiet, wind noise, and the best range, most efficiency, you know, and the way to do it is just make it as slick as possible. But it's just not really working for me. It's just, they all just look like a weird egg. And the Maybach version now it's just like a two-tone egg. Now it's starting to border on some kind of Easter egg. Like, it's just, and I was like, I just gotta, maybe it's, you know, it's in the photos. I gotta see it in person. And I, you know, and I drove the electric SUV and the sedan, and it's a nice car to drive. The interior is amazing. The big screens that go, you know, all the way across the dash and stuff. It was just, but you get out of the car again, you look back at it and you're like, I mean, I don't hate it, but certainly don't love it.
Yeah, we had a GLS over the weekend, not the Maybach one, actually, an AMG one, which was, and I took the family up to the mountains in it, and my wife suddenly turned around to me, this thing's 160 grand, and she said, if you take the big like star badge, which is really big and ostentatious in those ones, you take that away, like, why does it look like a Kia? And I said, well, it kind of looks like a Kia because one, you've got several requirements. You've got like legislative requirements around safety. You've got aerodynamic requirements. You've got packaging requirements. So once you're like, I remember talking to Ian Callum, Jaguar's designer, about all this, and he's saying that the challenge of designing something different is once you put all those touch points on paper, you kind of start off with the same box. And then it's like how you finesse the details. And so when they've got then into EV world, I mean, Mercedes is sort of, I think to your point, it's like, oh, it needs to look aero and a bit more futuristic, but still look like a Mercedes so we don't, you know, upset traditional buyers and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and I think we were expecting, as a company and as a test team, we expected massive things from the EQS, which was like their first kind of bespoke real EV at that point, or first sort of luxury EV into the US. And it was a bit disappointing. And it just felt, you know, that there's serious compromise, that car, rear headroom, rear comfort, which is weird because it's a sort of S-Class sedan. And Mercedes, BMW has taken the view, and we talked about this last week, that they're just going to do one car and then give you the choice of either electric or gas propulsion. So you can have a 5 Series or you can have an i5, a 7 Series or an i7. And it's pretty much the same thing. Mercedes basically said that brings too many compromises. We're going to spend the money and we're going to do an S-Class sedan, which is gas, or we're going to do an EQS, which is electric, but which is, you know, bespoke. So, you know, you kind of imagine that if they're going down that route, it's going to be mega. And, you know, I think the EQE SUV and the EQS SUV are better than the sedans. But even the EQE sedan, which I drove recently, even the AMG version just left me a bit cold, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's all right, but it's not, you don't get in to think, my God, I'm driving the future.
Right. Although on the design,
less impressive in many ways.
They're trying to get to it, and it's just a weird, slick looking kind of interesting thing. And I don't know, they're trying to give it kind of a grill, but it's not really a grill. You know, but they don't need the grill. So what are they doing on the front? And yeah, it's like, I thought, you know, a CL500 was a cool looking Mercedes, you know, this is not that.
I quite like the new SL. I think it slightly polarizes, but I quite like the new SL.
Yeah.
There's still something special about a Mercedes SL because of all the heritage and the history. You know, that's a nice thing. I love the new, I think what is an amazing piece of Mercedes design, the new AMG GT, the coupe, that I saw that in Monterey. That was that's the very cool looking car. They're just the proportions and the way it sits.
Right. So
excited about that one.
Yeah. So now to your point, they can do it. They can make a nice looking car. I just don't think they're getting it done on the electric ones, you know, but I don't know, maybe the benefit is in how it rides, or, you know, its performance, meaning range and
yeah,
you know, noise, you know, wind noise and stuff.
But I still in the best looking EV out there is the Lucid, and the Lucid's an amazing piece of design. I know we've had our challenges with the one that we bought, and you know, it's been a challenge with some of the reliability and stuff, but some of the engineering's fantastic, but as a piece of design, it's fabulous as well. It looks, you know, it looks expensive, it looks different, but not in a way that kind of puts you off. I think it's just brilliantly executed.
I think it's interesting. I think there's mixed reviews on the design. That light bar in the front, when I see it lit up like that, all I think is RoboCop's helmet, but with the mouth hanging down, like the human mouth with the RoboCop.
That does age you, though. RoboCop's helmet really ages you. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, they did a reboot of that movie not too long ago, but yeah, but definitely the
early 90s?
Yeah.
RoboCop, early 90s?
Yeah. By the way, Maybach 97 to like 2013 was that initial run. 2012, somewhere around there. 97. So
I thought it was pre 2008.
Yeah, so you were on the Concorde in 97, 98.
But maybe that was the concept. Maybe that was the concept. No, this I was on the Concorde. That would be early 2000s. So it'd be like 2003, 2005, something like that. But I think that was an early concept, not the production car.
Right. Okay. I mean, Lucid's good. I think Lucid's better than Mercedes as far as the look on it now.
It's a piece of design, yeah. And also some of the packaging. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, the Lucid's an amazing job of some of the packaging. If they just, the Lucid's problem is more about sort of building the thing. And also with all of these startups, I don't know if you saw in the week, there was a piece of data came out, a report on Rivian. And I think Rivian's losing like $30,000 per car that they build. So the car costs $30,000 more than they can sell it for. And, you know, this is a challenge with a startup. You just need to get to scale quickly. And, you know, this would be a challenge for Lucid. It's a challenge for Rivian. And obviously people like Mercedes are trying to still run this as a more of a traditional business rather than a kind of startup model. So changes the dynamic a little bit.
Do you think companies like Lucid and Rivian, and they're kind of at the top of the list of potentially could really make it, but I wonder if they can make it. And honestly,
I'm not as close to the finances. I mean, I think Rivian's got a better product lineup at a better price point, and is also a little bit diversified with the Amazon deal where they're making electric vans for Amazon as well. Lucid, I think, has got the wrong product at the wrong price, in terms of a luxury sedan, and they're just not making enough vehicles. I think they made about 6,000-7,000 last year.
And they're trying to be aggressive, you know, on a pricing and a leasing model now on you know, the entry level version of it. They're trying to make it
which is a trick to move volume, but isn't necessarily moving volume at a profitable way. They need to get their SUV into the market, and they need to get some scale. I mean, Lucid has Saudi Arabian finance behind them, which might help. So I think with all of these things, you know, it is unbelievably difficult, and we, you know, at Edmunds, we've been quite critical of some of the build issues that we've had with our Lucid and some of the test cars. And, you know, we have some difficult phone calls about that. And that's, you know, that's understandable because there's a lot at stake here. Launching a car company is unbelievably difficult. And you saw with Tesla how long it took them to get the build quality up to an acceptable level. And even today, there's still some question marks around Tesla's ultimate build. You know, and now they don't, you know, Tesla had a 10-year head start on everybody else, whereas Lucid and Rivian and others don't. You know, they're suddenly getting into a market where people like, you know, BMW, Porsche, Mercedes are already here and established and building, you know, building good product, whereas Tesla was the only game in town. So people forgave them more because there wasn't really an alternative. So I think it's so much harder to launch a new brand today. And then, of course, you know, you've also got all the, you know, Chinese brands, and, you know, are driving the Volvo next week. I'm off to Barcelona in Spain to drive the EX30, which is Volvo's new entry-level electric SUV that's going to have a super aggressive price point. And, you know, that's obviously, you know, Volvo's obviously got Chinese money behind it now. So there's, you know, there's this whole sort of cavalry coming from across the world, and, you know, not to mention, you know, the Japanese brands, when they eventually get their act together in the EV world, and then the Korean brands doing fantastically well, you know, Kia, Hyundai, making some fantastic EVs. So it's just really difficult. And the market, particularly in Lucy's case, for luxury sedans, where the cheapest one is, what, 80 grand, and then it goes up from there. You know, it's just not a very big market these days.
And I think that the opportunity to be acquired as a company, I think that's sort of past. I don't think anybody's going to be really looking aggressively at Lucid or Rivian or some of the other brands that we don't get to talk about, like Mullen and some of the other ones. I don't think anybody's looking at them, even Fisker, looking at them and going, we need to acquire this brand, because they're not.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
There isn't any one of them that are really doing it so well that somebody looks at it and goes, this is worth a multi-billion dollar acquisition.
Is there sort of equity in the brand? I mean, that's where, you know, you've seen over the years, like Lotus keep changing hands, Aston Martin keep changing hands. And, you know, that famous joke about friends of David Brown, you know, DB5 was asking for a, you know, could they have a car at cost? And he said, yeah, that'll be like 20 grand more than this is in the 50s or 20 grand more than what I'm charging. And
yeah,
it's Aston. I don't think Aston claimed to have made money in the Ford era, but I think that was only if you can't, only because they were able to amortize so much costs across the Ford empire. But you know, Aston Martin, Lotus, they've just got so much brand equity that people just keep dreaming and keep buying them. And now, you know, Lotus is actually probably in a better place than it's been in for decades. You know, Aston Martin is, you know, has got, you know, decent money behind it again, is doing some good products. So, you know, these are long-term heritage brands. You know, somebody might take a look at something like Lucid or Rivian and say, actually there is, you know, it's a great opportunity to appeal to a slightly different audience, more of a kind of, you know, tech forward, you know, kind of audience than, you know, our traditional brand appeals to. But yeah, it's tough. You know, it's hard. I mean, we sometimes feel as a, you know, as a consumer brand, our job is to call the product as we see it, and basically to say to car shoppers, do we advise you to buy this car here and now? Would we advise you spending, you know, 80, 100 grand on this vehicle? And we have to give an honest assessment of that. And sometimes that's tough, particularly when it's a, you know, when it's a startup. And we all want them to succeed. You know, if someone says, oh, you know, you're hard on this, you're hard on that, that's your reality. Is as car people, you want to see Lucid succeed because there's lots of stuff in that car that's fantastic. You want to see Rivian succeed because it's shaking up the market. You want to see Tesla succeed. Well, Tesla is succeeding, but you want to, you know, you want to see that journey. Because it generally, you know, shakes up the whole market, but doesn't mean that you can then go around and say, oh, this is fantastic if it's not.
Right. Like Lucid wouldn't be something we could recommend at this time.
Depends. I mean, I think they're getting better. You know, the very latest ones are much better. And you know, so I think, you know, particularly with some of the lease deals going on, you know, if you can lease one for $750 a month, which is the deal that was being thrown around my Instagram, actually it becomes a pretty desirable proposition. So I think you just have to accept that you go into it. And but all of these products from startups, you know, it's not necessarily the same ownership experience as you would get from a BMW or a Porsche. Not that they're always faultless, but, you know, you've got to, you know, but there is an excitement about having the shiny new thing, as we know.
Yeah. Okay.
We're still waiting for our Fisker, actually, as well, for that matter. We're about to buy a Fisker, and that's.
I'm seeing them. I saw one this morning. I just saw.
Well, they're headquartered about a mile from where I live, so you would hope you'd see a handful, but yeah, we're still waiting.
I've seen two on the road in like around town in my neighborhood. Although it could be the same one that I saw twice, but. I don't know, slightly different neighborhoods, you know, in my area. And I passed one this morning, but it was weird. I was like backing out and I was like, why is this person driving behind me when they clearly see that I'm backing out? Anyway, it was a Fisker. Maybe they're trying to figure out how to drive, you know, figure out the buttons and the screen and tilt it around. And they're like, I just got in this thing. I don't know what's going on. But
I remember like I had some neighbors say, guys, you see so many Rivians around here. And I was like, you know, we're actually on the demo route because Rivian's like in El Segundo where we live, we're like on the demonstrations. So it's basically the same like test drive route going around every day. It's like, oh, so many Rivians.
Yeah, anyway, that's Fisker, actually a good point.
Fisker's in, Fisk is interesting because they're actually getting the same people to make the car as make BMWs and Mercedes and Magna Steyr, which is in Austria, I think. And they made G-Wagons for years. So they basically, there are probably not a lot of people know this, but it doesn't, BMW or whatever doesn't necessarily make, they do have their own factories, but they also outsource some of this stuff. And, you know, they at least know how to make cars, which is an interesting twist to the business model is, well, if the problem is building the things rather than designing them, then let's get somebody else to build them and we'll just do the design and the marketing and all the shiny stuff. So we'll see. And also Fisk is coming into the market at a much lower price point. So they're going to have to drive volume at that place. So it's really interesting. I mean, who will make it through and who'll be around in 4 or 5 years and which Chinese brands will be here? You know, then you've got like VinFast, the Vietnamese brand. It's a really interesting time. And, you know, in 10 years time, the market's going to look different again.
I like Fisker's strategy because so many of these startup car companies are having issues building and having quality issues, not just supply chain issues, but for Fisker to go, maybe we will build the car one day at our own facility.
Yeah, they're building their own plant. They're going to do that. But, yeah.
You know, like for now, why don't we get a partner that has been building cars for a long time and some pretty decent cars along the way. So why don't we get them to do it? I like that strategy. I think that's interesting. And I don't fault them for not wanting to build cars right away. It's a huge, listen, they arguably make less money per car by outsourcing it, but a far smaller cash outlay initially than going, hey, we need a $2 billion factory, you know, just before we can even make the first car, you know, and then because now these companies are not just building a car, they're building an entire factory from scratch and making that work before they even get to building the car. So it's a lot of money out the door. So anyway, it's an interesting strategy. You mentioned BMW a second ago. I saw BMW launch the new X2. What do you guys think of that? I know you're, I don't know if you were there for the launch of it or if you got a chance to drive it, but.
No, we've just seen it we haven't driven it yet, but it's, you know, I think every BMW is kind of, you know, at the moment with all the sort of, you know, design is sort of met with almost a degree of trepidation. I mean, this is actually one of the more conventional looking BMWs of recent times. And the idea of the X2 is that there is an X1, which we don't have. No, we do. We did have it for a while in the US, but then they have the X3, which is, you know, the bigger seller, but then they have the X2 is designed to be a little bit more kind of sporty in the way that the X6 is as well.
Like a little more of what they're calling a coupe, I guess.
Yeah. And this is what this is. It looks okay. I mean, it's a sort of, how would you describe it? I mean, it's still got that kind of like contemporary BMW thing with like the big grill
and some sharp angular lines. There's still a lot of sharp lines to it, but look in the lineup of funky looking BMWs, this ranks high. This is pretty nice. It's less funky is how they did it.
Yeah, and I think we'll see that. I mean, obviously the 5 Series is more conservative. The next generation, X5, will be more conservative. So it's, yeah, I think it looks okay. It's not going to be a huge seller in the US, but it's,
why won't it sell in the US?
I think there's something interesting to say about it.
Why won't it sell in the US? I mean, we like SUVs, and we're leaning more toward small SUVs. And I guess this isn't all electric, and maybe an electric version would be interesting, but
I think
maybe the
X3
is the big seller. Just too small or too,
yeah, too small and too expensive. It's a practicality thing, particularly in the US. You know, a lot of these things are bought by, you know, families and things like that. And the X3 is the X3, like the GLC, is actually quite a good, you know, a good size family vehicle, mm-hmm. like a Toyota RAV4, but posh. the X2 is just that little bit smaller, that little bit more compromised in space. So it works well in Europe, and they don't tend to sell a huge amount over here because nobody likes spending a lot of money on something quite small.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there isn't really a penalty. Even with gas costs as high as they are, particularly in California, there's still not a big penalty for, you know, for choosing space.
But a lot of these hard edges and the shapes and stuff that BMW is going to, we did all this with Lamborghini, right? Maybe we're still doing it with Lamborghini.
Yeah, but Lamborghini has a, Lamborghini's in a different place though, isn't it? Lamborghini is supposed to be like a massive extrovert thing. I don't know. I think a lot of it comes from Chinese market as well, where, you know, like Chinese tastes, or where, you know, if you're now thinking of that as your dominant market, perhaps, then, you know, you need something that stands out and makes a statement. I don't know. I'm excited by potentially the next generation BMW design with some of the recent concepts, but I'm not sure they needed to be, you know, their argument is it's a super crowded marketplace. You've got to be expressive. You've got to give people a reason to buy you, rather than just here's another BMW.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, they're a pretty successful company. They probably know more than me about it.
Maybe. We're not 100% sure. All right. So
sometimes you say that, and then sometimes you just realize like they stop, you know, like these things aren't selling because they're really ugly.
Yeah, that's it. Like, well, sometimes they just don't sell. Yeah. All right. So what you're going to head to Europe to drive Volvo. EX30.
Yeah, the EX30, which I'm really excited about, because
I'm interested as well. First of all, I'm a fan of Volvo. I think their design is on point. The shared tech and whatever the relationship officially is with Polestar, I like what's going on there. As you know, I just did Rennsport. I went up to Rennsport in the Volvo S90 recharge. I didn't do a lot of recharging, but I did drive that. And that was a nice ride. That's a really nice sedan, and comfortable, and a great seat. And it was a really nice car to drive. And seeing what they're going to do the EV end is interesting. Yeah.
And the big thing about this EX30 is that, you know, sorry to cut you off, Matt, but, you know, they're talking about a starting price of 35 grand. And if you then apply a tax credit to that, you're talking about a Volvo EV with, you know, a decent size and proper range for under 30 grand. So I hate to use the, you know, there's this always cliche about game changer and stuff, which is an expression I loathe, but this has the potential to be a really significant vehicle. So quite excited. I'm heading out to Barcelona for a couple of days next week to see everybody in there in Volvo and have a drive. So maybe we can talk about that next week.
It's sharp looking. It's got a good, you know, it's kind of good. It's going to be small, but it's
smallish, but it doesn't, I don't think you look at that and say, oh, this is a cut price car. No way.
Right. And Volvo to me still feels above average as far as like they're trying to go after. Yeah. I don't even know if we call Volvo a luxury brand, but I guess they're kind of going after what maybe Acura after. You would still think a luxury brand. So to say that, hey, you can get into this thing for, you know, for 35 grand or less with certain incentives. But if you said 45 grand, I'd be like, that's fine. That's fine with me because I'm getting a Volvo and I'm getting a luxury vehicle. It almost sounds like it's too inexpensive. Like they're going down market. Like, I just don't want you to get there and go, yeah, the EX30 is nice, but if you're going to get the $34,000, $35,000 version, don't expect much. But if you get the $43,000 version, then it's a nice vehicle.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a bit of that. We'll find out.
Yeah.
We'll find out. I got a long flight.
You got a long flight. All right, let's
not very eco-friendly, is it, flying to Barcelona to drive an EV
fly to Barcelona and back to drive an EV.
Let's not think about that. Let's move on.
What do you say? I think we're wrapping things up. I think we're wrapping things up for the week anyway. What's coming up on you, Drags, besides us in some future episode.
Besides us, I can't give the game away, Matt. It would be wrong. It's highly confidential. But all I can say, subscribe to the Edmunds YouTube channel. If you just look for Edmunds Cars, you will find all the latest U drags and everything else that we're testing. We can do the X30 drive and all sorts of cool stuff.
All right, fair enough. We'll take it. Edmunds.com is the website, as you guys know, and we appreciate you listening to the podcast. We'll catch you guys next week. Until next time.
Yeah, and thanks for all the I'm still getting Instagram messages at We've Run Cars and stuff. I know you do as well, and it's nice to hear from everybody. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Hey, listen, so far so good. I got more positive messages than anything. Actually, I got only positive messages on the show. That's good. So people seem to like your British accent.
Oh, that's nice. Unlike my YouTube antics.
Yeah, YouTube is a different audience. Thanks, guys. Until next time, keep the air in the spare and the bag of the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.